Chapter 26. Cerberus Hades, Delta Pavonis Heliopause, 2566. Sylvester had not seen his wife for hours, and now it seemed as if she would not even be present for the culmination of all that he had striven for. Only 10 hours remained until Valiova's weapon was due to impact Cerberus, and in less than an hour from now, the first wave of her softening up assault was scheduled to commence. This in itself was momentous. Yet it appeared that he would have to witness it without Pascal's company. The ship's cameras had never lost sight of the weapon, and even now it hovered in the bridge's display, as if only a few kilometers away, rather than more than a million. They were seeing it side-on, since it had begun its approach from the Trojan point, whereas the ship remained in a holding pattern 90 degrees clockwise, along the line which threaded Hades and its furtive planetary companion. Neither machine was in a true orbit, but the weak gravitational field of Cerberus meant that these artificial trajectories could be maintained with minimal expenditure of correcting thrust. Sajaki and Higazi were with him, bathed in the reddish light which spilled from the display. Everything was red now. Hades close enough that it was a perceptible prick of scarlet, and Delta Pavonis, faint as it was, also casting ruddy light on all that orbited it. And because the display was the only source of light in the room, some of that redness leaked into the bridge.
"Where the hell is that Brezgatnik Kalvalyova?" Higazi said. "I thought she was meant to be showing us her Chamber of Horrors in action by now."
Had the woman actually done the unspeakable? Sylvester thought. Had she actually decided to ruin the attack, even though she had masterminded the whole thing? If that was the case, he had misread her badly. She had inflicted her misgivings on him, fueled by the delusions of the woman Kuri. But surely she hadn't taken any of that seriously. Surely she had been playing devil's advocate, testing the limits of his own confidence.
"You'd better hope that's the case, son," Calvin said.
"You're reading my thoughts now," Sylvester said aloud, nothing to conceal from the partial triumvirate convened around him. "That's quite a trick, Calvin."
"Call it a progressive adaptation to neural congruency," the voice said. "All the theories said that if you allowed me to stay in your head for long enough, something like this would occur. Really, all that's happening is that I'm constructing a steadily more realistic model of your neural processes. To begin with, I could only correlate what I read against your responses, but now I don't even have to wait for the responses to guess what they'll be."
"So read this," Sylvester thought. "Piss off."
"If you want rid of me," Calvin said, "you could have done so hours ago. But I think you're beginning to rather like having me where I am."
"For the time being," Sylvester said. "But don't get used to it, Calvin, because I'm not planning on having you around on a permanent basis. This wife of yours worries me."
Sylvester looked at the triumvirs. Suddenly he did not want his half of the conversation to be public knowledge, so he switched to mentalizing what he would say.
"I worry about her too. But that doesn't happen to be any of your business. I saw the way she responded when Valiova and Kuri tried to turn her."
Yes, Sylvester thought, and who could honestly blame her? It had been hard enough for him when Valiova had dropped Sunstealer's name into the conversation, like a depth charge. Of course, Valiova had not known how significant that name was, and for a moment Sylvester had hoped that his wife would not remember where she had heard it, or even that she had ever heard it before. But Pascal was too clever for that. It was half the reason he loved her.
"It doesn't mean they managed, Cal." "I'm glad you're so sure."
"She wouldn't try and stop me."
"That rather depends," Calvin said. "You see, if she imagines that you're putting yourself in harm's way, and if she loves you as much as I think she does, then stopping you is going to be something she does as much out of love as logic. Maybe more so. It doesn't mean she suddenly decided to hate you, or that she even gets pleasure out of denying you this ambition. Quite the opposite, in fact. I rather imagine it's hurting her."
Sylvester looked at the display again, at the conic, sculpted mass of Volyova's bridgehead.
"What I think," Calvin said eventually, "is that there may be rather more to any of this than meets your eye, and that we should proceed with caution. I'm hardly being incautious."
"I know, and I sympathize.
The mere fact that there could be danger in this is fascinating in itself, almost an incentive to push further. That's how you feel, isn't it? Every argument they could use against you, you would only strengthen your resolve. Because knowledge makes you hungry, and it's a hunger you can't resist, even if you know that what you're feasting on could kill you.
I couldn't have put it better myself, Sylvester said, and wondered, but only for an instant.
Then he turned to Sajaki and spoke aloud. Where the hell is that damned woman? Doesn't she realize we have work to do?
I'm here, Volyova said, stepping into the bridge, followed by Pascal.
Wordlessly, she summoned a pair of seats, and the two women rose into the central volume of the room, positioning themselves near the others, where the spectacle playing on the display could best be appreciated.
Then let battle commence, Sajaki said.
Volyova addressed the cache, the first time she had accessed any of these horrors since the incident with the rogue weapon. In the back of her mind was the thought that at any time one of these weapons could act in the same way, violently ousting her from the control loop and taking charge of its own actions. She could not rule that out, but it was a risk she was prepared to take. And if what Curie had said was true, then the Mademoiselle, who had been controlling the rogue cache weapon, was now dead, ruthlessly absorbed by Sunstealer. Then at the very least it would not be she who tried to turn the weapon's renegade. Volyova selected a handful of cache weapons, those at, she assumed and hoped, the lower end of the destructive scale available, where the destructive potential overlapped with the ship's native armaments. Six weapons came to life and communicated their readiness via her bracelet, morbid skull icons pulsing. The devices moved via the network of tracks, slowly threading their way out of the cache chamber into the small transfer chamber, and then deploying themselves beyond the hull, becoming, in effect, hugely over-cannoned robotic spacecraft. None of the six devices resembled any of the others, except in the underlying signature of common design, which was shared by all the Hell-class weapons. Two were relativistic projectile launchers, and so bore a certain similarity, but no more than as if they were competing prototypes constructed by different design teams to satisfy a general brief. They looked like ancient howitzers, all elongated barrel, festooned with tubular complications and cancerous ancillary systems. The other four weapons, in no particular order of pleasantness, consisted of gamma-ray laser, bigger by an order of magnitude than the ship's own units, a super-symmetry beam, an AC-AM projector, and a quark deconfinement device. There was nothing to compare with the planet-demolishing capability of the rogue weapon, but then again, nothing which one would wish to have pointed at oneself, or indeed the planet one happened to be standing on. And, Volyova reminded herself, the plan was not to inflict arbitrary damage on Cerberus, not to destroy it, but merely to crack it open, and for that a certain amount of finesse was in order. Oh yes, this was finesse.
Now give me something a novice can use, Curie said, dithering in front of the Warchive's dispensary. I'm not talking about a toy, though. It's got to have real stopping power.
Beam or projectile, madam?
Make it a low-yield beam. We don't want Pascal putting holes in the hull.
Oh, marvelous choice, madame. Would madame care to rest her feet while I search for something which matches madame's discerning requirements?
Madame will stand if you don't mind. She was being served by the dispensary's gamma-level persona, which consisted of a rather glum and simpering holographic head projected at chest height above the slot-topped counter. At first, she had restricted her choices to those arms which were arrayed along the walls, stowed behind glass with little illuminated plaques detailing their operation, era of origin, and history of usage. That was fine in principle, and she had soon selected lightweight weapons for herself and Volyova, choosing a pair of electromagnetic needle guns which were similar in design to shadow play equipment. Volyova had, rather ominously, mentioned heavier ordnance, and Curie had taken care of that as well, but only partially from the displayed wares. There had been a nice rapid-cycle plasma rifle, manufactured 3 centuries ago, but by no means outdated, and its neural feed aiming system would make it very useful in close combat. It was light as well, and when she hefted it, she felt that she knew the weapon immediately. There was also something obscenely alluring about the weapon's protective jacket of black leather, mottled and oiled to a high sheen,
with patches cut away to expose controls, readouts, and attachment points. It would suit her, but what could she bring back for Volyova? She perused the shelves for as long as she dared, which could not have been more than 5 minutes, and while there was no shortage of intriguing and even bewildering hardware, there was nothing which exactly matched what she had in mind. Instead, she had turned to the Warchive's memory. There were, Curry was reliably informed, exemplars of in excess of 4 million hand weapons, spanning 12 centuries of gunsmithery, from the simplest spark-ignited projectile blunderbusses to the most gruesomely compact concentrations of death-directed technology imaginable. But even that vast assortment was small compared to the Warchive's total potential, because the Warchive could also be creative. Given specifications, the Warchive could sift its blueprints and merge the optimum characteristics of pre-existing weapons until it had forged something new and highly customized, which, in minutes, it could synthesize. When it was done, as it was with the little pistol Curie had imagined for Pascal, the slot in the tabletop would whir open, and the finished weapon would rise on a little felt-topped platter, gleaming with ultra-sterility, still warm at the residual heat of its manufacture. She lifted Pascal's pistol, sighting along the barrel, feeling the balance, running through the beam yield settings, accessed by a stud recessed into the grip.
"Suit you, madame," said the dispensary.
"It isn't for me," Curie said, hiding the gun in a pocket. Volyova's 6 cash weapons powered up their thrusters and vectored rapidly away from the ship, following a complex course which would position them to strike against the impact point, albeit obliquely. And the bridgehead, meanwhile, continued to reduce the distance between itself and the surface, always slowing. She was certain that the world had already decided that it was being approached by an artificial object, and a big one at that. The world might even recognize that the thing approaching it had once been the Lorien. Doubtless, somewhere down in that machine-permeated crust, a kind of debate was going on. Some components would be arguing that it was best to attack now, best to strike against the nearing thing before it became a real problem. Other components would be arguing caution, pointing out that the object was still a long way from Cerberus, and that any attack against it now would have to be very large to ensure the object was annihilated before it could retaliate, and that such an open display of strength might attract more attention from elsewhere. And furthermore, the pacifist systems might say, so far this object had done nothing unambiguously hostile. It might not even suspect the artificiality of Cerberus. It might only want to sniff the world and leave it alone. Volyova did not want the pacifists to win. She wanted the advocates of a massive preemptive strike to win, and she wanted it to happen now, before another minute passed. She wanted to observe Cerberus lash out and remove the bridgehead from existence. That would end their problems, and, because something similar had already happened to Sylvest's probes, they would not be any worse off than they were now. Perhaps the mere incitement of a counterstrike from Cerberus would not constitute the interference which the Mademoiselle had sought to prevent. After all, no one would have entered the place, and then they could admit defeat and go home. Except none of that was going to happen.
"These are cash weapons," Sajaki said, nodding at the display. "Are you planning to arm and fire them from here, Ilya?"
"There's no reason not to.
I would have expected Courier to direct them from the gunnery. After all, that's her role."
He turned to Hegazi and whispered, loud enough for everyone to hear, "I'm beginning to wonder why we recruited that one, or why I allowed Volyova to stop the trawling."
"I presume she has her uses," said the Chimeric. "Curie is in the gunnery," Volyova lied, "as a precaution, of course, but I won't call on her unless absolutely necessary. That's fair, isn't it? These are my weapons as well. You can't begrudge me the use of them when the situation is so controlled."
The readouts on her bracelet, partially echoed on the display sphere in the middle of the bridge, informed her that in 30 minutes the cash weapons would arrive at their designated firing positions, nearly 250,000 kilometers away from the ship. At that point, there would be no plausible reason not to fire them.
"Good," Sajaki said. For a moment I worried that we didn't have your complete commitment to the cause, but that sounds suspiciously like a flash of the old, Volyova.
A very gratifying, Sylvester said.